Good morning and welcome to The Third Degree, 2SER's half hour of environmental and social justice, current affairs and conversations. I'm Jess Minchell. On the show today, we take a detailed look at the concept of environmental crime. But first up, Australia's first radioactive waste dump gets a green light from Parliament. After nearly 2 years, the government's now infamous Radioactive Waste Management Act passed through the Federal Senate on Tuesday, with support from both the ALP and the Coalition. This new legislation paves the way for the federal government to unilaterally name a nuclear waste dump site widely expected to be at the remote Indigenous community of Muckaty Station near Tennant Creek in the Northern Territory. Traditional owners have been fighting the proposed dump for years, and it is a huge blow that this legislation was passed while there is still a challenge before the courts over permission to even use the site. Here's Western Australian Senator Scott Ludlam, the Greens' nuclear spokesperson, speaking to Simon Unwin yesterday about why he's opposed to the bill, why he's been opposed to the bill in Parliament for nearly 2 years.
It's an argument against this predatory approach of deciding that because the Northern Territory is constitutionally vulnerable, because Aboriginal communities are economically impoverished, then the best place for the nation's radiotoxic waste is on a cattle station outside Tennant Creek. The government started with a flawed premise, and therefore they've come to the wrong conclusion, and that conclusion will be fought until the government comes to its senses and we have a more sane process for dealing with the waste that does exist.
That was Senator Scott Ludlam speaking to The Third Degree yesterday. With the passing of the bill after nearly 2 years, we asked Nat Worsley of Beyond Nuclear Initiative if this was game over for the campaign against the dump at Muckaty Station.
Absolutely not, Simon. We just see this as one more sordid milestone in the process of trying to force this waste dump on the Northern Territory, but definitely the campaign to stop it is far from over. In fact, conversations I've had with traditional owners and people all around the country since the legislation was passed just indicates to me that people are now have a renewed momentum to actually build the campaign opposing the proposal.
One of the big stumbling blocks for this legislation is that there is currently a challenge in court over exactly who can give traditional owner approval for the land to be used as a waste dump. What's happening there with that court case?
And a group of traditional owners have launched this federal court challenge against both the Northern Land Council, who made the nomination of the Muckaty site, and also the federal government, who approved that nomination, to say that the correct people were not consulted and did not give their consent for that nomination. That's just one of the obstacles we consider may get in the way of this process. There's a very solid community campaign, and this has very broad national support. So actually, despite what happens with the court case, we think that there'll be a concerted effort to stop the waste dump being built.
That's Nat Worsley of Beyond Nuclear Initiative. We asked Senator Ludlam what happens if the case is successful.
If those applicants are successful in the federal court, it means the carpet's been ripped out from under the government. They've wasted 6 years and an unknown amount of taxpayers' funds, and they'll have to start again. Now, the bill provides them with a mechanism for starting again and pursuing precisely the wrong track and probably wasting another couple of years, in that it's asking people to put their hands up. The bill itself is riddled with references to land councils and Aboriginal people, so it's fairly obvious that the government is intending to pursue precisely the failed strategies of the last 20 years in insisting that if we centralise radioactive waste, it should go to an Aboriginal community somewhere. It's a terra nullius view, an empty land view of radioactive waste management that should have no place in a modern Australia.
Here's Nat Worsley on the legislation.
Court case is successful and the Muckaty nomination is overturned, then there are provisions in the new legislation that's passed, the National Radioactive Waste Management Bill, to open up a process of nomination nationwide. However, it's also quite clear from the legislation that this process itself would target Aboriginal land and would target the Northern Territory. It's interesting to note that there's been a number of Senate inquiries into the Northern Territory waste dump proposal over the years, and the recommendations of these have been particularly clear that any legislation about radioactive waste management should not target a particular jurisdiction, and that's exactly what Ferguson's legislation does. A Senate inquiry also said that the minister should take time as soon as practically possible to meet with the community that's at the front line of this dispute, which of course he has also not done.
So the South Australian government, in fact, was able to challenge a plan to have a nuclear waste dump in that state around about a decade ago, I believe. But the territories obviously don't have that same power or the same rights as states to mount a constitutional challenge. I mean, you've commented there that any other site, it looks like it would be likely on Aboriginal land, but will it also be specifically in the Northern Territory?
No, there's nothing in the bill that necessarily targets the Northern Territory, although obviously, as you pointed out, they're constitutionally vulnerable. The thing is, the Commonwealth can override a state as well, and what prevented that from happening in the instance of South Australia was A, the South Australian government was very strong against it, backing the views of the vast majority of the community. Again, similar to this case, it was led by very strong Aboriginal women in central South Australia who took up the cause that they simply didn't understand why their land was suddenly being targeted for material that is apparently so safe that it needs to be evacuated from major population areas. Now, the key difference really was that in that instance, with a Labor Party in opposition, the Senate would have been able to block Commonwealth attempts to override the South Australian Parliament. Now, what we've got here is the Labor Party leading the charge. They've actually flipped, they've changed sides, now they're voting with the Coalition. And so we will potentially see the overriding, or we have seen now because the bill's gone through the House of Representatives, the wholesale overriding of territory and state legislation that would be designed to safeguard people and the environment.
It has been quite a long road for this particular piece of legislation to get through. I mean, why now? What's changed so that the government's been able to push this legislation through at this point in time?
Well, look, they could have pushed it through 2 years ago. So really, they've had the numbers all along. I think I've been able to do as best as possible to make sure that it was subjected to committee review. The government wanted an 11-day committee inquiry, and we persuaded them to take a lot longer than that about it. But ultimately, this process, it's in the hands of the government and the opposition. They had the numbers to crash this through a while ago, and they've chosen to do it yesterday. I think it was, you know, the first principle that we came from. If they're insisting on moving such an obnoxious piece of legislation through, at the very least, they should have waited till the federal court matters were heard, and they didn't even do the traditional owners from the NT the courtesy of waiting until the land dispute had been resolved.
If the federal court challenge is unsuccessful, what's the time frame for this dump to actually be started, and what are the ways in which the campaign can move forward from here?
Well, the timing is entirely up to the government. They can potentially move very rapidly, and I suspect they will, to declare that Muckaty is the site, and then these processes could swing into gear very quickly. As soon as they've nailed the site, and which of course this bill enables them to now do, that then sets in train quite complex approvals procedures under the Environmental Protection Biodiversity Conservation Act and also the Radiation Protection and Safety Act. So there's quite a way to go, and we will now be taking the arguments to Ministers Burke and Roxon, the Minister for Health and Environment, respectively, that they've been handballed a pretty nasty project, and it's their role and their duty now as ministers to safeguard the environment and public health and throw this thing out.
We asked Nat Worsley yesterday as well about the other directions that the campaign's been going in. For example, in the communities along the highways between Lucas Heights Nuclear Reactor and Muckaty Station.
Well, over the years, Friends of the Earth in particular has done a lot of work contacting the communities along the proposed transport route. And you can guess that seeing as the traditional owners at Muckaty haven't met with the government to be able to discuss their concerns, and not for lack of trying, it's purely because the minister refuses to meet with them. But given that, you can understand that most of the councils along the transport route also haven't been visited by Minister Martin Ferguson, and there is strong opposition. So the work that Friends of the Earth has done has been to actually visit these areas and let them know both about the proposal and also about the opposition from traditional owners. And there have been a number of councils already passed resolutions to say we do not want this radioactive waste coming through our community. We understand there's a risk to the workers who are transporting it. There's a risk to our community in case something happens. And we know that the people who are set to be at the receiving end don't want it to go ahead.
Even if this campaign has been going for quite a number of years now, what do you think is needed to actually prevent this waste dump being forced on this community?
Well, the Cooper Peter Coolgatjuta in South Australia fought against the South Australian nuclear waste dump proposal for 10 years. We're coming up to 7 years now, and I see them as part and parcel of the same campaign to stop a federal government seeing a remote Aboriginal community as a sacrifice zone where they can dump their problems on. What we'd really like to see happen is to take a step back and stop trying to choose a remote postcode and look at a thorough process. Nationally, environment, health groups and trade unions have been calling consistently for an inquiry to happen, an independent inquiry that brings all the stakeholders to the table to consider the range of options of radioactive waste management. I'll just add a message to Minister Martin Ferguson and the government that the community is extremely determined to fight this proposal. And once again, the Minister and any other members of the Federal Parliament are actually invited to come to Tennant Creek to meet with the people who have been fighting this campaign. It's very important that people on the ground affected by this have the opportunity to speak to people and let them know what's proposed.
That was Nat Worsley from Beyond Nuclear Initiative speaking with Third Degree Simon Unwin. You also heard there WA Green Senator Scott Ludlam discussing the impact of this new radioactive waste management legislation.
2SER, independent and community focused, volunteer powered and listener supported. Switch on.
You're listening to The Third Degree. I'm Jess Minchell. We're now going to take the time to look a little more in depth at a concept hugely relevant to a lot of stories we cover here on The Third Degree, but don't usually get a chance to look at specifically, and that is environmental crime. At the end of February, 20 governmental agencies and organisations met in Canberra to talk about environmental compliance and enforcement strategies. It was the first time this summit was held in Australia and formed part of a lead-up to Australia attending the International Chiefs of Environmental Compliance and Enforcement Summit in France at the end of the month. Dr. Samantha Bricknell is a research analyst with the Australian Institute of Criminology, and she attended the Australian talks. I spoke to her about the concept of environmental crime, and I'm asked her first up, what is her definition of environmental crime?
Definitions around environmental crime vary considerably, but usually the one that we employ is harms that are committed against the environment that violate current law. So there has to have that legal criminal aspect to it. But there are a whole raft of harms that comprise environmental crime as it's recognised within Australia.
And what does environmental crime look like in the Australian context? What are the main issues?
As mentioned, there are quite an extensive range of environmental harms that we recognise within Australia, and compared to our near neighbours in the Southeast Asia and Pacific region, we don't experience the same level of environmental crime as they do, which is good news for Australia. But we do have issues with water theft, we do have issues with illegal native vegetation clearance, there is certainly activity in wildlife trade both within Australia but also moving some of our native species across to Japan, Europe, in the Asia region as well, Southeast Asia. That's predominantly our birds and our reptiles and to some extent our spiders. We do also have issues with fishing, mostly in the commercial fishing sector. There's a little bit of illegal fishing occurring with recreational fishes. But of course, we also have international fishes that are moving into our waters, predominantly from Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, who are coming in here and illegally taking our fish species.
So just a little bit more on that international aspect, what does environmental crime look like internationally? And for example, you're mentioning there some distinguishing aspects of we don't have the same problems as they do in Asia Pacific. What were you referring to there?
Well, a lot of the issues that we're finding with environmental crime do tend to occur in developing countries, and a lot of that is to do with poor law enforcement in those areas. A lot of the enforcement officers are poorly paid. Engagement in environmental crime can be quite lucrative. There's a lot of numbers floating around about how much the wildlife trade actually creates monetarily. No one's actually been able to prove those numbers, but it's an issue for those countries where it's easy to bribe a law enforcement officer. Can be good money for the law enforcement officer to allow illegal environmental commodities to go through. And there are links with governments, there are links with corruption. Whereas in Australia, we have very strong environmental laws. We obviously, our Customs and Border Protection Service are monitoring exclusively what's going along our borders. And we have state and territory environmental regulators looking at different aspects of environmental harm. And for that reason, and I think obviously higher prosperity in this country, we do have lower levels of environmental crime occurring here. But as mentioned, probably much more sustained in developing countries where those law enforcement issues are a little bit more problematic.
Clearly there are issues between international jurisdictions. Mm. But also, how difficult is it, even in Australia, to prevent and seek proper redress for environmental crimes across local jurisdictions, particularly if they are crimes that are affecting water bodies or air bodies that don't have defined borderlines?
It is difficult in the sense that environmental harm is often defined as or described as a victimless crime. So it can be very difficult to actually detect an environmental crime is occurring, and often relies on what an academic has referred to as the nosy neighbour syndrome, where someone has actually spotted someone doing something that looks like it's not quite correct, but also regulators going out and checking up on individuals. To do any kind of potentially environmental harmful activity within Australia, you have to have a permit for. So that's taking water, if you're working with native animals, or if you want to remove vegetation from your land, you have to apply to an environmental authority to do so. So there's a lot of, you can imagine, a lot of auditing that has to be done by our regulators, and they can't be everywhere at every time, so things are going under the radar and being committed. But even when environmental harms are being committed and have been picked up by environmental regulators, and when they're particularly serious cases, they're moved on to law enforcement, our police, who investigate these particular crimes, it can be very difficult to mount prosecutions. A lot of evidence is required, and sometimes even at court hearings, it's very difficult to be able to explain the magnitude of that harm to the judiciary for them to understand what the extent of that harm is, and therefore to apply the appropriate penalty. There is improvement in that. There's a lot of work looking at harms and how to explain those harms, particularly in the court setting, because a lot of these hearings are held at the magistrate level. And we are seeing more substantial penalties that are being assigned to environmental harms. But there's also talk that maybe traditional penalties are not the way to go, and that we should be looking at alternative sanctions such as doing an environmental good, that is giving some money to fund a rehabilitation project rather than actually just fining the company or the individual.
Are there also issues in Australia between the different environmental protection authorities in the different states? Are there large differences in terms of penalties and laws across the different regions?
There is a bit of a disconnect in the comparability between the laws, and you will see in some jurisdictions the penalties for a similar offence are a lot lower. One example that I always give is when you look at harm towards a protected species. In some jurisdictions, it carries quite significant financial penalty or custodial sentence, whereas in some other jurisdictions, and I won't name names, but that may not have a custodial sentence attached to it, and the financial penalty is actually half to a third of what might be assigned in a neighbouring jurisdiction. Another issue, of course, is potentially not across state and territory borders, but maybe more so within borders, because that's where most of the attention of individual regulators will be focused, is coordination between agencies. And certainly when we held a round table looking at environmental crime, a lot of the regulators and law enforcement said that they would like to have more coordinated activity, because there are some harms such as illegal native vegetation clearance, which does affect other aspects of the environment which other regulators may be interested in. So it's not just the removal of the vegetation, it may be also affecting water sources, it may also be affecting biodiversity in that region. So a number of players do need to be involved in that, and sometimes that communication between regulators and to law enforcement isn't as good as it could be.
So you presented on behalf of the Institute of Criminology at the inaugural Australian National Environment Enforcement Summit that was held in Canberra a few weeks ago. What were the useful things that came out of having the 20 different government agencies and organisations in the one room for the summit talking about environmental crime?
I think one of the particularly important outcomes from that summit is for all the agencies to really recognise who's engaged in this space. And one would assume, and these were predominantly Commonwealth agencies, there are only, a few state and territory representatives, but one would assume that they're all aware of what each other's doing. Well, it turns out probably that wasn't the case, and certainly I'm aware that a number of people who came along to the conference were really educated in terms of the sorts of work that different agencies were doing. It was very dominated by representatives from SOPAC, which is the Department of Sustainability, Environment, Water, Populations and Communities, which look after a whole raft of environmental legislation, and also members from the Australian Federal Police, because they are now getting more and more interested in combating environmental crime. So really the take-home message, I think, from that forum was two things. There are a lot of players who are interested in environmental crime, and an interesting component of that is there's a lot of talk about it being an emerging issue, which I'm somewhat bemused by, because it's certainly not emerging in the sense that it's only starting to occur now. It's been occurring for a long time. What's emerging about it is that a lot of the agencies, and particularly law enforcement, are now focused on that because there may be an organised crime involvement in some of these activities. But it also, it's a form of criminal activity which is very difficult to deal with. I think the second take-home message, which is probably emphasising the point that I was making beforehand, is that incredible need for coordination of effort, both within the regulatory space, but also between regulators and law enforcement. And without that, environmental crime will continue apace, and the perpetrators won't be aware of the sorts of difficulties they may get into if they're actually detected engaging in this form of criminal activity.
Is environmental crime undertaken or is committed by Australian organisations or companies that are overseas? Did that form part of some of the discussions at that summit?
It certainly wasn't discussed at the summit. From what we could gather in the report that I wrote for the ASC on environmental crime, and I should add that it was on open source materials, so that somewhat limits the information that you're working with. It does appear, with the exception of obviously illegal fishing that's been committed by Indonesian and Papua New Guinean fishers, and to some extent the wildlife trade, most of it is probably being committed by Australian citizens or Australian residents, definitely obviously water theft and illegal native vegetation clearance. And recreational and commercial fishing would be committed by Australian residents. And there's a whole raft of offenders there. There are some people who have just do not understand the laws or have decided to flout their permit requirements on a particular occasion and were just unlucky for them to be committed in the act, up into what we could describe as organised activity, which again would probably be more related in your fishing, maybe your wildlife trade.
And what about more large scale, such as Australian mining companies overseas?
We didn't look at mining, and I'm not an expert on environmental harms committed by environmental companies. I don't believe that there are any laws that if they commit an environmental harm outside of Australia that they are subject to Australian laws. They may well be subject, and I imagine they are, to environmental laws in the country that they've committed that particular harm. And again, within Australia, I understand that, and Queensland's a case in point, any environmental harm that's committed by a mining company within Queensland at the moment is under the environmental regulator there, but there is talk that those sorts of harms may be, or any activity that's undertaken that may affect the environment, may be moved, if the LNP get into power, may be moved over to the Department of Primary Industries. And I imagine across Australia there are different players looking at environmental harm that is committed by mining companies. But that's certainly something that we didn't look at. There are very, very strict regulations and around what mining companies can do, certainly within Australia. How that's occurring overseas, I think, again, it depends on which country they're operating in.
So you said a little earlier that there was some talk about different approaches to ways in which to either seek criminal redress or to penalise companies. Has there ever been much talk about keeping with the mining company theme, if, say, there is environmental damage committed by a mine, that instead of that company being responsible because they're in breach of their environmental regulations, the head of that company would perhaps face legal criminal charges. Has that formed much of the discussion or your work in terms of criminology about environmental crime?
No. We haven't really looked at that. We've had situations where, and this is with illegal native vegetation clearance. There was a case in New South Wales where quite a significant financial penalty was handed out, and in that case, both the individual and the company were had to pay a financial penalty for. In this case, I can't remember the hectares of vegetation that was cleared offhand, but a considerable number of amount of vegetation was moved, and it was also moved in a protected area under Ramsar, which is a wetlands protected area. So it was a very significant case, and ordinarily one would be applying penalties to the individual or the body corporate, but in this case, both the individual and the company that he represented had to pay a financial penalty. I'm not sure whether that occurs in instances where there is environmental damage caused by mining companies, so I probably couldn't comment on that. But I guess based on that one case that I'm aware of, and I'm sure there are a few other cases, particularly also with pollution crimes, where you're having individuals and companies that are being penalised at the same time, that may well be happening with mining companies.
You attended this Australian National Environmental Enforcement Summit a few weeks ago, and that was in the lead-up to the Environmental Compliance and Enforcement Summit that is being co-organised by Interpol and the UN Environmental Programme France. What do you see as the main areas that either came out from this summit or that you feel are most relevant for Australia going into that summit in France?
Well, I think it's very important that Australia has a role in this summit, not just for Australia's involvement in preventing environmental crimes, but also the role that we may play in providing expertise and assistance into the Pacific and the Southeast Asian region. Interpol, who are one of the mob that you mentioned that are hosting this summit, they have been engaged in the environmental crime space since about 1992. They predominantly focus on wildlife and pollution crimes, but I do believe that one of the purposes of this summit is again to improve this coordination of activity, not just within regional or territory borders, but to be able to provide recommendations and advice and expertise and guidance to a broader range of countries which may not have engaged in the environmental crime problem up until recently, and to better, I suppose, get the dialogue going between countries that have more experience in the environmental crime space with those that have less experience in combating or successfully combating environmental crime, but also being able to bring in the issues of compliance and actual criminal activity. Because a lot of environmental crime that occurs, and maybe environmental crime is not the right word in this context, is about non-compliance. You're not complying with the provisions around the particular permit or license that you've got, and then you have the more serious matters, which are the criminal matters. And I think it's being able to bridge across the two, recognise what's non-compliance, what is actual criminal activity, but provide that education and that dialogue and that inter-country effort to combat environmental crime, particularly of the transnational component.
That was Dr. Samantha Bricknell from the Australian Institute of Criminology speaking with us about environmental crime. The Third Degree is 2SER's Environment and Social Justice show, and I'm Jess Mintle. We'll be back next Thursday, but stay tuned for Steph on the Daily. ¶¶